Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Hello, listeners of Fully Booked. Our podcast network, Podcast One, has a brand new app for you to discover the show. Find out everything about your favorite Podcast One shows, including Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, through the all-new Podcast One app available now in the App Store or on Google Play. Find links to articles, social media, make playlists with your favorite episodes, and connect with other Fully Booked fans. You can even create your own polls for the latest book releases. We have our own little community on there. Check out exclusive content such as behind-the-scenes photos and so much more. And if you have 360-degree video or watch a bunch of shows in virtual reality, there's over 1,000 videos on the app right now. It's like you're in the studio. There is no other podcast app like this one. Download the all-new Podcast One app in the App Store or on Google Play today.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
I wanted to write a book that talked about race and racism and the impact of all of these things that really was focused on how an African American family interacted with each other.
Lady Hubbard's novel, The Talented Ribkins, is about a family who has special powers and the complications that arise from having those powers. Our reviewer says that Hubbard writes about this family with, quote, prodigious skill and compelling warmth, and also says in a starred review that the novel is clever and bold, and I agree. Hubbard is a winner of the 2016 Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award and teaches at Tulane University in New Orleans. Welcome to the show, lady.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
So tell me a little bit about how the idea for the novel came to you.
It evolved over a very long period of time. I read a lot of Du Bois's work. A lot of the initial inspiration for it came from thinking about his concept of the talented tent and sort of the impact that had had on ideas about the traditional Black middle class in the South. And then in around 2010, I wrote a short story that eventually, after much thought, it took a while for me to realize it was the beginning of the novel, but it became the first chapter of the novel. So it was a lot of thought and in a lot of different directions eventually came together and coalesced as this book.
Yeah. And so this W.E.B. Du Bois essay called The Talented Tenth was written by him in 1903. And it basically is an argument that African Americans at that time were only going to do better by being led by sort of the tenth of the African American population that had sort of talent and leadership ability. Is that right?
Right. He was saying, I feel like the essay really needs to be contextualized sometimes for people, because it really was, at the time, there were not very many educational opportunities for African Americans in the South at all. And so he was arguing for a liberal arts education to be made available to African Americans. And that was his argument, was that a tenth of the population was endowed with this natural talent that would enable them to become a leadership class if they were trained properly. So that was his argument at the time. And so the term has been around for a while. I was very interested in how it affected and reflected perceptions of the Black middle class as sort of like a leadership class.
Right. And in 1903, was that a kind of revolutionary argument to make?
Oh, that's interesting, as a revolutionary argument. The reason I think it's important to remember that he was speaking within a specific context, and he was also speaking to a specific audience, is because it sounds very elitist. when people read it now. Right. So, and that's something that I'm interested in as well. But so I don't know. I mean, I think that just thinking that a lot of people really didn't believe that African Americans should be educated at all at that time. So in that sense, I guess it was revolutionary. It certainly was very impactful. Right. It was very impactful. Yeah.
So tell us, for anyone who hasn't read The Talented Ripkins, tell us a little bit about what happens in the novel.
Well, it's about a family in an African-American family in Florida, and every member of the family has a specific, unique talent that they're born with. So one can see in the dark, one can scale any walls, and the main character, Johnny Ripkins, can make perfect maps of any landscape he passes through. And part of why I did that was I really just wanted to make the idea of talent something that was tangible, that people actually had to negotiate in their own lives as opposed to sort of an abstract notion. Mm-hmm. So you have a family and they all have different talents, but they don't really know what to do with them. So they often sort of have just become idiosyncratic compulsions. That's how they appear to other people a lot of the time, because it really does affect their behavior, and it affects the way in which they see the world and try to negotiate their way through the world. In terms of the plot, when it starts, Johnny Ripkins, who's the main character,
he's in a little bit of trouble, right?
Yes. He owes a debt to, he's a gangster of some sort, and he has to raise money. And the way he's doing that is he is traveling through the state of Florida, and he is digging up money that he buried in holes in the ground at various points in his past. So he is sort of revisiting places that were significant to him in his past in order to retrieve the money he left there. And it's causing him to have to sort of deal with a lot of unfinished business, things he didn't really, he'd never really concluded certain situations and certain relationships. So he's dealing with his past, and his first stop is to the childhood home of his deceased half brother. And when he gets there, he realizes he has a niece that he did not know he had. So for the rest of the book, she's accompanying him on this journey. And for her, it has a completely different significance, because she's meeting all of these people and learning all these things about both Johnny's past and her father's past that she didn't know before. So they're both in the same car and they're tracing the same routes, but it has a very different significance for each of them.
Right. And she, all the people that they encounter are a little bit older than she is. And so it's naturally sort of built into the sort of feel and plot, I guess, that she would look up to these sort of larger than life figures, right?
Yeah. Yes. I think so. I think that's part of where the idea of them as superheroes comes from, is her perspective of sort of all the history that her elders were involved in, and that they were part of, you know, this really, really significant history that she was not there to experience. So there is sort of a bit of, I don't know, she idolizes them to a certain extent or just their experiences. So that definitely shapes her perception.
I love that sort of the technique there where, you know, you're using real life relationships and the sort of natural feel of them to increase the superhero feel of that aspect of the story. So nice job.
Thank you.
So as you mentioned, you first published a short story about Johnny Ripkins, and I guess that became the first chapter of this novel, if I'm correct. But you didn't return to that story to turn it into a novel until a few years after you had published the story, right? And I wonder, you know, in that intervening time, like what drew you back to the story to turn it into a novel? Did the characters just like not let you go, or what was up there?
Well, it was definitely the characters. And even when I wrote the story, none of them are specifically real people. They're all totally figments of my imagination, but there is something about Johnny Ribkins that did remind me a great deal of my grandfather. And my grandfather actually did die, or he passed during the period between when the story was published. And I think it made me really think about the character, and also how my own construction of that character related to things that I wanted to say or felt were really important or very meaningful to me about my own grandfathers. I'm sure it was very, very personal. I just wanted to write more about them.
Yeah. So what was your grandfather like? And were you able to get some of his personality into Johnny, do you think?
I do. They're very, very different, which is, I suppose, really important to say, because I don't always know how he would feel about me saying that. He was a chemistry professor, and I think the connection definitely is the role of education in his life, because he's someone who really, really, he grew up in the South in the rural North Carolina, and his family definitely did not have enough money to send him to college, and so he worked. He actually walked to the school that he wanted to go to, and he wound up working in the kitchen for several years before he had saved money to take classes there. And also, I'm told by one of my uncles told me he got a basketball scholarship also, and so then he was finally able to take classes there, and he persisted and ultimately became a chemistry professor. And I've always found his story really inspirational. And also I was very moved again by his own belief in the transformative potential of education. And so I think that maybe affected the way in which I was thinking about the essay and how it pertained to these characters. Yeah. And also the idea of talent. And there's so many people that have talent that goes unrecognized or misunderstood. And I was always very inspired by my grandfather's persistence and his pursuit of what I'm sure for many people around him must have seemed a very obscure dream and ambition. Yeah. So that's part of my inspiration for the book. You can hear him in Johnny's voice, or I can hear my grandfather in Johnny's voice a lot of the times, even though what's on the page is really different from who my grandfather was. But there are certain similarities. Yeah. Certainly in his relationship with Eloise.
Yeah, yeah. So these superpowers, one member of the Ribkins family is able to, quote, spit firecrackers. Another has a right hand that is as powerful as a hammer. As you said, another one can climb walls. They're really interesting superpowers. Is there one of those superpowers that you like the most, or that was the most fun to concoct?
Oh, it's true. I think I would really like to climb walls if I could. And it's a nice metaphor for me. I really would like to climb walls. So in terms of fun, yeah, just thinking about, there's a point in the book where Johnny asks Franklin about that. And he says at some point in his life, he realized if he couldn't fly, he would just have to climb. And I often feel that way in general. Yeah. It's a metaphor, not literally climb, but but it's true. It's like
I was gonna say start small.
Yeah. No, not literally, but yeah. In terms of a lot of ambitions or goals I might have.
Yeah. In addition to being sort of a really entertaining novel, The Talented Ribkins is also about racial and sort of social inequality. Is it a difficult thing to sort of weave a big thorny topic like that into a entertaining novel?
I don't know. I think that it's because it is such a part of people's reality. I just wanted to, the way in which I tried to address that was how it felt organic to me, was in a way that felt organic to me. So, and it is a big issue for, I mean, it's something that, that people have to live with and sort through and find ways to love each other anyway. So I really, I wanted to, well, one thing is I wanted to write a book that talked about race and racism and the impact of all of these things that really was focused on how an African-American family interacted with each other. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I just was tried to be honest about that as much as possible.
Yeah.
But so as opposed to, like, you know, naming issues in another way or an external way, just really thinking about how people process these things and their relationship to things they might have to deal with daily in terms of how they interact with each other. Because I think that underneath everything, every character within the book is aware that every other character has to deal with these issues all the time. Mm-hmm. So they don't always talk about them explicitly. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah. It does.
So, okay.
And we don't have enough novels about African-American families interacting with one another, you know? So it was really nice to see that in the midst of all this superpower stuff.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So back to these superpowers, I guess I can't get over them. Because you mentioned that you wanted to make them feel organic. And I... You know, one of the admirable things about the novel is that they do feel organic. And I wondered if you feel like there was some sort of trick or if you had to work hard at that to make them feel organic, because it's something nice about the novel.
Yeah, I actually didn't really, I mean, I don't think I put a lot of conscious thought into it, which sounds strange, but because it, for me, it, I'm glad that it came across as organic because it felt very organic for me when I was writing it. Mm-hmm. Because on a certain level, it really is about how the different characters sort of negotiate the world, like how they deal with the world. Their powers really do dictate. It dictates a lot about how they see themselves. And it, again, it dictates a lot in terms of how they interact with other people and what their responses are in certain situations. So it did just feel like a tangible manifestation of who they were for me as characters. So they're almost like all different approaches to negotiating reality, right?
Yeah.
That's how it felt when I was writing it. And then, of course, they all present to Eloise sort of slightly different versions. Well, some are not slightly different, but different versions of sort of what how you should live a good life and what one should do. And in part, those are coming from they're coming from who they are as people, and the differences between how they see that and how they perceive the world and how they perceive what a good life means is also reflected in their talents as well.
Yeah,
that was part of the point, again, of trying to make it make them tangible as opposed to just sort of an abstraction, was to give them all like physical abilities that they had to figure out what to do with.
Yeah, making the talents manifest.
Yeah.
So you have a degree in creative writing, but you also have one in dramatic writing. Do you write plays in addition to novels?
I don't, and I haven't for a while, but I'm definitely still affected by the amount of time that I sort of spent studying dialogue and telling stories through dialogue, because that was very important to me when I was writing this, was trying to get the dialogue right and people's speech patterns. And I did learn a lot from trying to write plays. I have not done that for a very, very long time, but I still really love dialogue and I really love writing it. And Yes, that was it was a big part of writing this book, definitely.
Yeah, dialogue is one of the funnest parts of fiction writing, I think.
I do too. Yeah. I definitely do too.
So you, as I said, you teach writing at Tulane, and you, of course, used to be an MFA student yourself. Do you find that your students nowadays are, you know, pondering how to create a working, you know, working lives as artists that are different from how you were thinking about those things when you were a writing student? I mean, in other words, do you think there's more hope for young students who are dreaming about becoming working artists?
Well, I will clarify one thing is that I wasn't teaching creative writing at Tulane. Mm-hmm. I taught a class in Afrofuturism.
Oh, wow.
Actually.
Oh, that's great.
I teach in the Africana Studies program at Tulane.
Yeah.
When I teach there. So, I wasn't teaching creative writing students. And as for attitudes about it, I can only speak from my own experience. Therefore, I don't know really why. I have, as you mentioned, a number of degrees, none of which are particularly lucrative fields to go into. So, yeah, I don't know. And I probably would definitely be the wrong person for anyone to come to for any kind of practical advice whatsoever.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I'm afraid so.
Yeah. And so you teach or you have taught Afrofuturism. Who were you teaching in that class?
Oh, the writers?
Yeah, which writers?
Oh, we read a lot of different things. We read, Octavia Butler, of course, and Samuel Delaney. We read Henry Dumas, and they read Amos Tutuola. We also had guest speakers come in. There was a presentation on Sun Ra and a presentation on George Clinton, and we watched a lot of, it was a very fun class, by the way, that all of the readings were just, it was very fun. I really enjoyed everything that we read in there.
Yeah.
But we read a lot of short stories. So they read quite a few different authors. So that's just a sample.
No, yeah. It sounds like a great class. So it feels to me like this novel could become a great movie. Are there any plans for that?
Not definitive now. I mean, I would love to see that one day. But no, right now there aren't any specific plans to make it into a movie.
And if that came about, would you want to be involved? I mean, you love writing dialogue, and a screenplay is all about dialogue, right?
Oh yeah, no, sure. I would love to do something like that. Yeah. I think it would make a great movie too, by the way. I would love to see that.
Yeah. You're just putting the word out there in case anyone's who has the ability to do that is listening. So, what's next for you? What are you working on now?
I've been working on a novel about Johnny Ripkin's grandfather, the Rib King, which is a character that comes up a lot actually in this first novel. It's a very, very different book, however, but the main character is their patriarch, I suppose, and he calls himself the Rib King, and that's also the title of the book right now.
Oh, great!
The work title, yeah.
So those of us who love this novel, you're giving us something else to go for. So that's great.
Yeah.
Well, congrats on this. Really enjoyed reading it, and thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And it's wonderful to have a chance to talk to you.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books right here on Fully Booked.
Hi, this is Ben Domenech, the host of the Federalist Radio Hour. We're a daily show coming to you 5 days a week from Washington, D.C., where we interview our nation's top journalists, politicians, authors, chefs, economists, entertainers, and more. If you're looking for a contrarian discussion on news, politics, or culture, give us a listen and subscribe at podcastone.com, the new Podcast One app, or at Apple Podcasts.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
So this is our Overlooked Books episode. Every year at Kirkus, we at the end of the year, we try to think about the most overlooked books of the year, and that could mean that the book is overlooked in terms of sales. It could mean that it's a great book and not enough book critics paid attention to it. And actually, the talented Ribkins was reviewed pretty widely, but it's one of the joys of being a critic to be able to say, hey, we think you should pay attention to this and you might have missed it. So, Megan, which overlooked writer are you talking to today?
Well, I'm glad that that was a broad definition of overlooked, because Marlena, a debut novel by Julie Bunton, doesn't technically qualify. I mean, it was blurbed by Laurie Moore. It was an Indie Next pick and a Book of the Month selection, and it was named a Best Book of 2017 by NPR, Publishers Weekly, Esquire, The Washington Post, and look at that, Kirkus Reviews.
Yeah.
But the reason I chose to revisit Marlena for our year-end coverage is because I believe it needs to be more widely read. It's really excellent, and it has one of the most effusive Kirkus reviews that I've seen this year.
Oh, wow. Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, should we call her up?
Yes, please. Julie Bunton, welcome to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, Megan. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
I am extra excited to have you here because I do believe that our critics' review of Marlena is the most effusive review of a debut in 2017 that I've read. I've got a little bit here, if I may extol your virtues. The quote is, "Sensitive and smart and arrestingly beautiful, debut novelist Bunton's tale of the friendship between two girls in the woods of northern Michigan makes coming-of-age stories feel both urgent and new. It is, our critic says, a novel set in a world so subtle and nuanced and alive that it imprints like a memory, and Marlena is devastating, as unforgettable as it is gorgeous." Now, we are not known for our effusiveness.
Yeah, I kind of know that from working in the industry. I've definitely seen a few Kirkus reviews that have not been as kind. So I was absolutely thrilled that the reviewer felt that way about the book. And it was like one of the most special moments of the whole process for me. So definitely something I'm sort of cherishing. You know, there's not always that many. It can be a little bit traumatic publishing a book. And that was one of the things that was just like a gift, felt like a gift, really.
Well, that makes me want to go in a different direction. That usually at this point in our interview, I would have that proud and steady workhorse of a question, you know, what is this book about? But before we get to that, what has your experience been like over Marlena was published on April 4th, 2017, correct?
Yep.
Over the last 8 months, what has your experience as a debut novelist been like?
Yeah, it's so funny. It's been like such a... First of all, I mean, it's been like a great privilege, and it's a dream to have a book that you work. I worked on Marlena for about 7 years, all told, and to have it be out in the world and, you know, finding the readers that it means something to. And I've been lucky in getting, you know, reviews and comments from critics that have largely been very, very kind. And I feel like really generous. I think one concern I had was that writing a book about teenage girls, especially a book about adults for teenage girls, like about teenage girls, but for adults.
Yeah.
There was some worry that it wouldn't be taken seriously from a critical perspective. And that hasn't been the case at all. So in all those ways, I felt like totally over the moon and lucky. But I guess I would say, like when I said before, I kind of like touched on it being a little bit traumatic. I think what I mean is just that, like, when you take something that's so private and so much a part of your inner life and your internal world, and you make it and it becomes public, and like, that's kind of, it's the end stage of any writing project. But like, it's not easy. Even when it's positive, it's like, there's a sense, I felt like sort of a sense of loss a little bit. I also felt a kind of like disjunction between the subject of my book, which is often, it's not a happy book really. Though I hope some readers find moments of happiness in it. It's about difficult things. It's about addiction, and loss, and like, have, as someone who also works in publishing, like going around being like, this is my debut, it's very sad. And having people have to reconcile that with like who they know in the world, that was like a weird challenge that I sort of didn't foresee. But ultimately, it's been kind of a great whirlwind, I think.
Yeah. As your reader, I can attest that it's not just all sad. It's a well-crafted world. So there are even moments of humor, especially for me in like teenagers' dialogue.
Yeah. Like, yeah. I love writing teen dialogue. It's like my favorite thing to do.
Well,
teenagers are so funny.
They're hilarious. As we were, I'm sure, at the time, though I didn't know it. One of the things, well, I think that you've partially answered already what is this book about. Is there like more of an encapsulation, like a kind of a plot geared encapsulation you might want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's funny. After 8 months, you think I'd be better at this, but it's something I think I'll never get good at. And my day job, I work for Catapult, this small independent literary publisher, and I always am counseling our authors and like the writers on our team to like talk about their books and like a quick little, like not kind of give them a nutshell quickly and efficiently, but I can never do it myself. But I guess what I would say is just that it's narrated by a woman in her early 30s, who's looking back on a formative friendship she had when she was 15 that ended tragically, a friendship with an older girl, Marlena, who was her neighbor and really just kind of dropped into her life and changed it. But of course, it's no spoiler to say that Marlena dies and will die before the end of the year. After they meet each other, it's told from the third page of the book, I think, is kind of where I dropped that off. So for me, really, yeah, like the book was about grief, and there was never a question of like, will I hold that information that she dies? Like, will I keep that from the reader? Like, it was really about that feeling of like standing on the tracks, the train's barreling down on you. You know, something's going to happen that's bad, but you can't change it, because to me, that's what grief felt like. And then the sort of like more personal side of this is that I lost a friend in my early 20s to complications related to substance abuse. And while the story isn't like that story, and it's certainly not autobiographical in the sense of like plot, it does kind of contain, I think, some of the emotional truth of that experience, and just like struggling to make sense of how losing someone changes what comes after, if that makes sense.
It does, you know, and in telling the story of her friendship with Marlena Catt, who is narrator of this book, I wanted to ask you what role nostalgia plays for her specifically in this story, in telling us this story, and if it played a role for you in writing the book.
Yeah, that's such a good question. And no one's asked me that before. And there's almost like two ways of answering it, I think. Yeah. On the one answer is like, absolutely, yes. Like, I sometimes think I'm from Northern Michigan, and the book is set in Northern Michigan in a fictionalized version, really, of the place I grew up, with some tweaks. But like, and I've lived in New York ever since, just like Kat. So there's some similarities, certainly, in like our trajectory through the world. But like, when I was writing the book, I wanted to go home. Like, I desperately was living in New York, broke most of the time, like longing for like Lake Michigan and like the beach and the snow and like all the places I had known. So that, in that kind of sense, that nostalgia is sometimes like a yearning or a longing to return to something gone. Yeah. I was just like doing some channeling, like some feelings that were very much my own. I was also listening to like a lot of things I listened to as a teenager, to kind of get back to that space. But I was also interested in nostalgia as like a, this is a little esoteric sounding, but like almost like a literary idea or how it shapes the narrative. I was really interested in the writing of the book. Like, I hope that a reader isn't distracted by this fact, but it is very much like a part of the story for me. Like, what does it mean to tell a story about your own experience? And in Kat's case, like, she's telling this as if it's her most intimate secret. Like, how does nostalgia change or alter how you think about someone gone? How does it like distort the memory so that there's almost another loss in that, right? Like, in remembering somebody, you're remembering, you can't really remember it as it was. So you're kind of like losing it again or recreating it, an altered version of it. And there's a sadness to that, that's kind of tied up in nostalgia. Like, nostalgia isn't honest, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I was very interested in that and how that would distort the narrative and change how Kat looked at things.
It's interesting because one of the things you do so stunningly well, to my mind, in this book is write about friendship between young women. And like that, that's a special kind of friendship that you're bound to lose anyway as you both age and evolve, right?
I mean, totally.
In this case, with Marlena's death, you know, by the third page of the book, we know that it is lost. It is a hard loss, but it's something, mm-hmm. you know, I don't have in my life now, you know, as a 35-year-old, but I did then, and I identified with super well, especially that particular process, that series of recalibrations we undergo as young women to forge a best friendship.
Yeah, I'm so fascinated by that. I think like girls, I hope it's changing, or not necessarily hope, because those experiences are really foundational experiences for me, mm-hmm. and important to me and important to who I became. But I do think there's like something about being a girl, is growing up as an adolescent girl in a rural conservative small town, like yeah. you're vulnerable to many kinds of danger.
Yes.
Whether it's just the danger of like not being able to become a fully realized version of yourself because there's not space for it, or the dangers of men who, you know, don't have your best interests at heart, or the danger of being sexualized to you, whatever, drugs, mm-hmm. alcohol, all of that stuff. But having a best friend is like a way of making your, like, doubling down on your own strength. It can yeah. also be dangerous too. But yeah. it's like together you can become something stronger than the individual girl. And I was mm-hmm. very fascinated by that. And I think, you know, the ways we make room for each other and don't, also kind of like the ways that girls kind of toxically have to navigate stereotypes about girls.
Yeah.
Like one girl gets to be wild. One girl is a little bit less so. Like in my friendships growing up, there were never like two wild girls. There was always somebody who's like more this way. You know, we all yeah. had to play a certain role. And what does mm-hmm. it mean when like we're assigning those roles without thinking them through? How do they change what we really become? I just think it's such an interesting kind of dynamic. And it's cool to me that there have been so many books kind of exploring this lately. I think it's a really interesting fictional like thing to poke at, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. To, you know, my eye, it almost feels like Kat is under the influence of Marlena. You know, she and
yeah.
Marlena is a particularly intoxicating, magnetic kind of person in her own way.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Kat can't see her either. Like, she can't mm-hmm. see. She only sees what's intoxicating about her, not what's vulnerable. She doesn't, yeah. she decides that Marlena is like the strong one, and realizes sort of too late that she was wrong about that. I was interested in that too, kind of how we hide things from our friends and don't.
So again, to restate it, we know from page 3 that Marlena will die. But I was wondering, after reading an interview with you at the Rumpus, there's a quote from that where you said, "I kept thinking about how much more open to experiences I was as a teenager. Teenagers mostly say yes, I think, and adults mostly say no." And I was wondering, like, if as a guiding principle of teenagers saying yes more frequently than adults, like, how that shaped the plot of this book. Like, did you wind up in surprising places?
Yeah, that's such a, Megan, these questions are so good. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, it did. Like, it definitely did. It, you know, sometimes people ask me, a question I get a lot is like, what was the hardest part about writing this book? And I never really know how to answer it, because writing, I actually don't think is like hard or easy. Like, it's all just writing. Like, if you can get to a place where you're writing, you're just writing. But I mentioned that in the context of that question, because one thing that was sort of challenging or surprising was like writing about characters who are often getting themselves into trouble when you love your characters. It's just like sort of painful sometimes. Like, I would be like, oh, I know Kat's going to do this right now, and I really don't want her to do it. It's like sloppy and bad, and it's not going to turn out well. Or like, Marlena, don't do, you know what I mean? Just like,
yeah.
the way you want to protect anyone you love. I definitely felt very close to them, and I didn't, but I knew also too, like, I felt like I had a sense of who they were, mm-hmm. and that it came from that, like, knowing that both of them were in a place where they were going to say yes. And Kat, maybe that's not as much part of her personality, but she's in a situation in this moment because of Marlena, the moment of the book, at least, where she's going to. And that's kind of her transformation, or it was for me, from beginning to end.
There's a particular act of vandalism that was another humorous spot for me in reading this book. but our listeners are going to have to read it for themselves to find out what that may be. I guess I'd just like to ask you, Julie, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners about this novel? Anything at all?
Yeah, that's a good question too. I mean, I just hope that, and I guess maybe I'll say this. One thing that's been, and I think this is only something I could say after, you know, 8 months out from publication. One thing that's been startling to me a little bit about the reception of the book, just from like talking to readers at events and stuff, is it strikes me how uncomfortable we often are in the presence of girls doing things that are self-destructive or ugly or hard to understand, and how much less room we give girls to make those kinds of mistakes. I think it's been interesting seeing how uncomfortable we still are with like a teenage addict or even like an adult alcoholic, like a woman who behaves in these ways. And those are things that are in the book very, very much so. So I guess there's not really like a takeaway from that, but it's just been an interesting observation that's helped me kind of understand a little bit more about how delicate it still is to kind of tell stories of addiction and why these stigmas are kind of still limiting to people who are struggling with this in real life. So it's just been kind of an interesting thing to observe. I don't know exactly what I've learned, but it does make me glad that I wrote about it, I suppose, to give kind of more, create more space for stories like this.
I'm glad you did too. And I thank you for this book, and I encourage our listeners to go out and get Marlena, a novel by Julie Bunn. Thank you for joining us today on Fully Booked.
Thank you, Megan. Thanks so much for having me.
Our editors certainly have opinions on what they consider the most overlooked books of 2017, so now they join us here on Fully Booked. They are nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, fiction editor Lori Muchnick, and children's and teen editor Vicki Smith. Hey, Vicki.
Hey, Megan.
How are you doing today?
I'm okay. How are you?
Very well. Thank you for asking. What's your pick for the most overlooked book in children's and teen, or books in children's and teen literature for 2017?
Well, this is my pick for the most unjustly overlooked book for teens of the year. I think that there are a lot of books that we overlook that, you know, are just as well overlooked, but this is one that should not be. It is called When Morning Comes by Arushi Raina. She's an Indian-Canadian author, and it takes place during the Soweto uprising in June 1976. Wow. And there are four point of view characters, and sort of the pivot character is a young Black woman named Zanele. And she's determined to fight the man and put everything she's got on the line against the in the student protest against the unjust language laws. And the other three characters who sort of pivot around her are Mina, who is the daughter of an Indian shopkeeper nearby, and Tabo, who's a Black gang member and a confederate of Zanele's, and then Jack, whose mother employs Zanele's mother in her home as a housekeeper, and who thinks he's sweet on Zanele. And he is big into sort of ostentatious risk-taking. We first meet him, he's put on blackface and has sneaked into a Black nightclub. You know, the tensions just get thicker and thicker and thicker, and the violence gets sort of looms bigger and bigger and bigger, and each one of the characters is put to the test. It's really artfully done and beautifully done. Our reviewer saw a real parallel between the storyline in this book and the sort of, you know, teens against the world plots in a lot of dystopian fiction. Mm-hmm. And she thought this is a great way to sort of take some of those characters out of boilerplate post-apocalyptic fiction and give them a really beautifully rooted historical story. I couldn't love it more.
Wow.
I know. Golly. Listen to that recommendation from Vicki Smith. Laurie, I hope yours is just as glowing, right?
It's hard to compete with Vicki.
What overlooked book are you wanting to tell us about today?
The first one is a book called Reservoir 13 by John McGregor. He's an author. This is his fifth book. He is British. I know at least a few of his books have been published here before, but I'm not sure if they all have, because I had really never heard of him before. And this book, by the time it was published here, it had already been long listed for the Booker Prize. And, you know, it seemed like he should have made some kind of splash, but it did, I think, just kind of disappear. It's a a quiet book about a young girl who disappears outside a small village in northern England. And, you know, so it starts out like it seems like it might be a mystery, but then it completely changes and it turns out really to be an exploration of the town near where she disappears. She's a visitor. She and her parents are visiting this town. She goes missing. And then each chapter, there are 13 chapters in the book, and each one covers a year's time. And they all start the same way. After the first chapter, they all start at midnight when the year turned, and then goes on to talk about, you know, what was going on New Year's Day and how the town was changing and people were going on with their lives. A creeping normality sets in, you know, while the girl is still missing and life goes on. It's quite hypnotic. I sat down to edit the review of this book and I just picked up the book to look at it and just started reading and just couldn't really stop. It's really captivatingly, beautifully written. So that is a good one.
That's great. Just in case listeners don't know, we review about 8,000 books a year at Kirkus. So for an editor of one of our sections to say that she actually starts, you know, becoming captivated by the book and reading it when she's supposed to be editing is a very strong recommendation.
It's true. It's true. And then I just wanted to briefly also mention another book called The Gift by Barbara Browning. Both, I also want to mention both of these books are from small presses. Reservoir 13 is published by Catapult, and The Gift is published by Coffee House Press's imprint, Emily Books. And it's, you know, there's so many fantastic books coming out of small presses all around the country. So it's nice to give them a little attention once in a while. Not that we don't, we do all the time, but we don't always mention who publishes the books. So The Gift is a kind of autofiction of the type that, you know, Ben Lerner or various other people are writing. It's like crossing the boundaries of memoir and fiction. The main character is called Barbara Anderson, who's sort of a stand-in for Barbara Browning. And she teaches performance theory in New York and records ukulele covers of various songs at night. And she just starts sending gifts of recordings, her ukulele recordings, to strangers she meets by chance on the internet or various other people. And it leads her into a whole series of events. Her fascination with what she calls inappropriate intimacy. So our reviewer calls it a delicious love letter to readers everywhere.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Hey, Eric.
Hey, Megan.
What's your choice?
It's really tough. There are quite a few on our best of list that I felt didn't really get the attention that they deserve. But I think one that's extremely timely and will continue to be is a book called All the Agents and Saints, Dispatches from the U.S. Borderlands. And that's by Stephanie Elizondo Griest, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Just to mention a really good small university press that does a lot of good trade books. But this is basically a mix of memoir, sociology, and reporting. The author grew up along the Texas-Mexico border, and she also worked at a Mohawk Indian reservation that straddled the New York State-Canadian border. So she has these kind of dual experiences about the things that go on in borderlands. And both of them share poverty, cruelty and misunderstanding among law enforcement agencies, some language problems. And specifically on the Mexico side, she experienced a lot of the drug smuggling and human trafficking. And I think especially these days with talk of this ridiculous wall that our president wants to build, this book is a great portrait of what's going on that's already there. And some of the most interesting parts are her travels along the sections of wall that already exist before Trump became president. So those kind of show the problems inherent in having walls separating borders. And it's just a really well-written revelatory book. Our reviewer said, in this well-conceived book, the author demonstrates unforgettably that national borders constitute much more than lines on a map. So I think the message is great, and the way she delivers it is top-notch.
I look forward to reading that one, perhaps over our upcoming holiday break.
Yeah.
Are there any other selections you want to share?
I'll mention, Yeah, I'll mention one quick one. It's called A $500 House in Detroit, Rebuilding an Abandoned Home in an American City. Mm. And it's by the author's name is Drew Philp. And in 2009, he bought a house in Detroit for $500. It was a 1903 Queen Anne with a beautiful wraparound porch, but it was completely run down. And, you know, he's this shy, kind of idealistic working class white kid moving into this area that's 80% black. And so there's a lot of good social interaction. But the most interesting thing is the process of rebuilding this house. It's monumental. And he basically does all of it himself using a lot of scavenged parts from throughout the neighborhood. Yeah, it's just a really interesting look at that part of Detroit. And our reviewer said it's a standout in the Detroit rehab genre. So there's a lot of books that are coming out about Detroit and other areas that are kind of coming back.
Very cool. Thank you, Eric.
Yes. Sure.
Yeah, thank you all for those great ideas. So that's it for this episode. We hope you join us next week for the December 26th episode, because we produced an event at the Texas Book Festival in November about the 2017 Kirkus Prize with five of our finalists, some of the best writers in this country, spanning from children's books to adult fiction and nonfiction. So we hope you join us for that panel next week. You know what to do. It's time to turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Podcast One has new shows on our new app. Check out all the cool features to help you explore our exciting new programming, like America's Lakers Podcast with Jay Moore, Sessions with Randy Jackson, So Random with Corinne Olympios, Attack Each Day, The Harbaugh's Podcast, Not Just Sports with Susie Schuster and Rich Eisen, and Sound of Success, The Dick Enberg Podcast, as well as your old favorites like The Lady Gang, Steve Austin, Shaquille O'Neal, and Adam Carolla. Get the new Podcast One app in the App Store, Google Play, or PodcastOne.com.